Thank you for tuning in to the Helium Radio Network. You are listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded show.
A patient comes into your office and says, "Doctor, I'm sick." And you say, "Yeah, you are." And the patient says, "Doctor, can you heal me?" And the doctor says, "Yes, I can." Who's wrong in that conversation? That's what I always ask them. And very few doctors get who's wrong in that conversation. The answer is they're both wrong. Because the doctor's assuming he can heal the patient, and the patient's assuming that the doctor can heal them. The truth of the matter is the doctors only promote healing, and the patient does the healing.
That's Stephen G. Taibbi, author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart, a true story based on his lifelong experience as a patient. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, bringing innovators and experts together to discuss the American healthcare system. Stephen G. Taibbi had surgery for the first time on his first day of life. Since that day in April 1953, he has had many more operations, including two heart transplants. A prolific writer, he finally published his memoir in 2019. Before writing his book, Stephen spent more than 25 years as a producer, director, and director of photography for his own television production company. He was also a contributing editor at Videography Magazine. He went on to be the vice president of Transplant Speakers International, an organization dedicated to improving the quality of life for transplant candidates, recipients, their families, and the families of organ and tissue donors. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here, Teresa.
I started reading your book last night, as I mentioned just a minute ago, and it is compelling from the very first page. And I appreciated that your approach to your life story has zero self-pity, a little bit of humor, and yet I felt so much empathy for what you endured as a very young child of five. Can you tell us a little bit about your healthcare journey? I know we could speak for hours just about your health alone, but maybe just sort of summarize it for the listeners.
In a nutshell, I was born with three deformities that caused my first three operations, which were minor, including that I have crooked thumbs, see? So, of course, radio can't see that, but pretend my thumbs are crooked. And that's because I have this thing called Holt Oram. They didn't know what that was. They didn't know what that was until much later. But that was an indication, and that indication meant that there were other things wrong with me, but they didn't know that then. They just went after the minor things, not knowing that it meant that my nervous system was different, my skeletal system was different, and my venous system was different. So the skeletal system, I could have ended up with my hands ending in a three-finger point that was fused, or my wrist was in a point, or my elbows would have been at a point. That's how that shows up, Holt Oram. I had the mildest way that it can show up, which was deformed fingers. The other thing it did, like I said, my nervous system is different. I have what they call a cookie bite hearing loss, and that's developed as I got older. A lot of the things with the Holt Oram are showing up now instead of when I was a child. And when I rub my eyeballs, they squeak. You can hear them. So that's one of the nervous things that, you know, from the nervous system. And venously, you know, it affected my heart. And I had something called ASD, which is atrial septum defect. And everybody knows that as a hole in the heart. And back in the 50s, that was a big killer of children. And when I had my first operation, the survival rate was 50%. When I had my second operation, no one had lived through two before me. I was the first. And so, you know, got last rites and all that stuff. But then I was, you know, told that I wasn't going to make it past 10. Well, my parents were told that. Then when I got older and I was with a doctor, a new doctor who was very straight with me, and he gave me a year to live when I was 16. I went in and I had some minor surgery over at Long Island Jewish. It was Long Island Jewish then. And they cardioverted me, which is they electrocute you and then they start you up again, hopefully. And that corrected the problem. And then they put me on a drug called quinidine, which was cutting edge at the time. And it turned out that I was allergic to it. And so on my 17th birthday, a day later, I had a heart block incident that almost killed me. I had the whole out of body thing, you know. Nobody thought I was going to live through that. And then after I survived that, my doctor said to me, Stephen, you'll be lucky if you can get out of your 20s. So I decided that I was going to live my life. I was going to chase it with a hammer is what I call it. And then when I was 33 and I still hadn't died, long after my expiration date, the doctor said to me after examining me with an EKG, he said, Stephen, I don't know what you did. I don't know how you did this, but your EKG is identical to any normal person's. Go out and live. So I went out, and on my 17th birthday, I mean, on my 34th birthday, the 17th anniversary of my almost dying on my 17th birthday, right. I bought a lighter to celebrate. So I bought my own airplane, and that's how I celebrated it. And everything was fine, and I was told everything was good. I got married, bought a house, all the things. And then all of a sudden, I didn't feel real good again. And I couldn't figure it out. And we didn't understand what was going on. And I had one of those wearable monitors. It didn't show anything. And then one day I was walking with my best friend who just recently passed from cancer. And I collapsed. And Larry had to pretty much carry me home. And the next day I was on a stress test. And when they put me on the stress test, and I'm 46 now, I collapsed in the first 30 seconds of the test, and I had to be given oxygen. And while they're giving me oxygen, they're telling my wife that I'm in full-blown heart failure, end-stage heart failure. And wow. And the thing about that was that I had caught a virus. It had nothing to do with my heart. So who says God doesn't have a sense of humor?
And here you are, two heart transplants later. What do you attribute that to? Your remarkable beating the odds time and time and time again at a very young age. Is that because you're from hearty stock, or is it mental? Is it like spiritual? How do you account for that?
Well, the doctors all along always told my parents and me now that I'm a fighter. And this is why I wrote the book, because everybody said to me, you have to write this. And I'm very proud of this book, I have to say, because I've been writing for a long time. And it's some people say there's one section where everybody just says they lose it laughing. And I'm just proud of how well I was able to put it down in a way that can relate to people. That was what I really wanted. And I wanted to get across the idea that I don't go into a doctor's office, let alone a hospital, without a strategy. And I developed strategies to survive at the age of 5. Now, they weren't the healthiest strategies. I wasn't exactly sure that that's what I was doing, but I did do it. And I realized that I had to fight for me. I realized the danger I was in when I was 5. Nobody told me, but I certainly knew. And I decided that I was going to fight. And I fought. It's important for people to understand this today. That's why I wrote the book. I want people to understand that there are strategies you can use when you're in hospitals. And whether you use mine or it's you just have an awareness that you can have your own because of what I wrote, you know, and give you an idea. I don't care whose idea it is, whose strategy it is, as long as you use it. Right. And you can get yourself out of a lot of trouble. And attitude is a huge part of your strategy.
Well, I want to say the thing that first drew my attention to you was I came across your LinkedIn profile, and it says, your bio says, and I'm going to quote, I want to start a movement to help patients understand doctors and doctors understand patients for better outcomes. And that to me is a remarkable statement. So what inspired that mission statement and what does it mean to you today?
It's the same reason why I wrote the book. And I am beginning to join up with some people now who are agreeing with the statement. And, I do speak at hospitals and to doctors and to patients. And it's a real – here, I'll tell you whenever I speak to doctors, I always ask them, a patient comes into your office and say, doctor, I'm sick. And you say, yeah, you are. And the patient says, doctor, can you heal me? And the doctor says, yes, I can. Who's wrong? Who's wrong in that conversation? That's what I always ask them. And very few doctors get who's wrong in that conversation. the answer is they're both wrong. Because the doctor's assuming he can heal the patient, and the patient's assuming that the doctor can heal them. The truth of the matter is the doctors only promote healing, and the patient does the healing. And that's the bottom line truth of it. And if you don't have that understanding that you're the one who heals, and if the doctor doesn't understand that he's the one who promotes your healing, but he doesn't heal you. I mean, they can say, look, doctors save my life all the time, but they're not the ones who healed me. I healed me, you know, and doctors will say, yeah, I just promoted your healing, but you did the healing, you know. But not enough doctors, well, I should say some of them do, some of them don't understand. They get this wrong idea that they're the healer. They're not the healer. The patient gets this wrong idea, the doctor will heal me. He will not. She will not. Right. You will. So whether or not you're going to come out of it is really largely up to you. Of course, it's a dance. If the doctor's terrible, maybe you're not going to come out of it, you know? But if the doctor's very good and your attitude is wrong, maybe you're not going to come out of it.
Right. Yeah. So it really is, it's a different way of looking at it and putting some onus on the patient and really putting the expectation that they are a participant, they're an active participant, or they need to be in their own well-being, their own taking charge of their own health.
When I just got my second heart transplant at Cedars of five years ago, it's almost 5 years this month. And I developed doing this at Columbia University Hospital in New York City, where I had my first heart transplant. I would not wear gowns in the hospital. I refused. I wore, you know, sweatpants bottoms, and I wore button-down shirts. And I wore them, A, because they were more comfortable, and B, because I wanted them to know I was here. Not some lump, not a widget in the factory of hospitalization, which it's really becoming more and more of. It's really frightening to me how much patients are becoming widgets. But I wanted them to know I was here. And a doctor at Cedars came up to me and goes, why are you wearing street clothes in the hospital? I said, because I'm more comfortable and because I want to make sure you know I'm here. And he said, I wanted to do a study on that because there's a lot of evidence that proves that when a doctor walks into a room with a patient wearing street clothes, they treat them differently than a patient wearing a gown.
It helps you maintain your humanity and your individuality. And I want to ask you about that as well. In the beginning part of your book, which is as far as I've gotten so far, but you talk a lot about the emotion of shame. And I was struck by that. I wondered where that came from and how it shaped you in your later life.
It was a big shaper in my life. I mean, when you're 5 years old and you go through that much shame, it's so much shame. You got to remember, this was the 50s. They are much improved with how they treat children today. But back then, and I say it in the book over and over, children were to be seen and not heard. Back then, as a child, they didn't think you understood anything. They thought they could talk over you and you wouldn't hear them. They thought they could rip your clothes off and be naked in front of a group of people, and they didn't think that would bother you. I mean, they did so many things to you that were shameful for yourself, you know, especially having to do mostly with nudity and examining you in places, never asking permission. Back then, they never asked permission. I mean, never. They just walked in and took your clothes off, which was just a gown,
right.
Which was one of the reasons why I hate gowns, because they're too easy to take off.
Yeah.
But a button-down shirt, they can get into a button-down shirt as much as they can into anything else. It's really not an impediment to them.
You also talk about the remarkable, which you alluded to a minute ago, coping mechanism that you developed as a five-year-old. Can you tell listeners about your cave and then also talk about how you adapted that into maybe a bit of a healthier coping mechanism as you matured?
Okay. I did what psychiatrists call disassociation. I didn't know that's what it was. You know, I was 5 years old, for gosh sakes. I had to disassociate myself from everything. It was horrible. It was a ward of children. I was with 16 other children in a giant room. It's not like it is today. And things were horrifying. I would watch children across from me. One kid across from me, actually two. I watched two children get taken to their deaths. And I knew that I got taken to their deaths because my mother, who was a nurse, was always honest with me. And she said, no, he's not coming back. They were because they were all male because we were in a male ward, you know. But I watched this one kid, as they tried to take him, fight and scream. And as they were taking him down the hallway, you could hear him screaming, strapped to the gurney, screaming. And he didn't want to go. He didn't want to go. And he never came back. And, you know, you see these things. You smell these things. They're hurting you all the time. They're hurting you all the time. And the way I dealt with it is I just built a cave that I could climb into that you couldn't see into. And when I was in that cave, my body was a separate entity. I was in my cave. My body was left on the bed. They could do anything they wanted to me. I never said a single word in the hospital unless I was asked to say something. I never even said, ouch. I never said, ouch. I never said, you're hurting me. Never. I just was in my cave from the second day I was there.
And how did that evolve? I mean, that's a harrowing story and to think about it. And I know that we have come a long way in hospitals and how children are treated and families are treated. And but as you got older, you adapted that, right? You that strategy evolved for you.
Yes, it did. But it took a long time to get rid of that. That was at the age of 5 that got so imprinted because I did it twice at the age of 5 and 6. I was in the hospital for 2 months, those two years. So a month each. And it really stunted my childhood. It stunted everything. I was unbelievably shy. I was, you know, I wouldn't talk to anybody. My head was always down. I always looked at my feet. I never saw the world around me until one day when I started my own business, I just realized that this can't be. I look too weak. And then I started to force myself to keep my head up. I started to force myself to look at people in the eye. I started to force myself to be more outgoing. And I would force myself at a party to go meet somebody new. I'd force myself on a line in a store to talk to the person next to me. I just forced myself out of it. That's what I did.
And what is your strategy today when you're going through a difficult situation? You talked a little bit about this in the book.
Well, the biggest strategy is gratitude. So I think it's the most important thing you can do in your life, no matter what your life is, that is to be aware of how much you have to be grateful for. And it's also a spiritual thing. And I really believe that we're kind of in God's holodeck. You know what a holodeck is from Star Trek? You know, it's this thing where it's a photon. It's a room made of photonic energy, and they can make any reality you want in it. You know? It's like a playroom. But I really believe that we're in God's holodeck. This is, and each one of us is in our own path, our own journey that God has put us on. I'm not a really religious person in the sense that I don't go to church, but I believe these kind of things very deeply. And I believe that everything that's happened to me happened for a reason, and it was part of the journey that was meant for me. So rather than lamenting that I'm in pain now, this is how I deal with things now, rather than lamenting that I'm in pain, rather than lamenting, oh my God, once again, I've been told I have a year to live. I've been told I have a year to live 3 times. And my parents were told twice. So 5 times they've said I have a year to live.
That's a lot of odd beating you've done.
Yeah, I know. I don't win the lotto, but that lotto, I'll take that. So I'm grateful because, okay, so I'm in pain, but that means I must need this pain for my journey. So this is a lesson. So be grateful for the lesson. And if you can turn things around that way, and you know, I see so many patients in the hospital and they're screaming and yelling at their doctors and they're being jerks. And you know what? You think the doctor or the nurse is going to want to work on you when you're like that? You think that's in your best interest? Your best interest is to make them want to be in your room, not to make them dread being in your room, right? But in the meantime, they're screaming and you're yelling and they're, oh my goodness, all these things happened to me. Blah, blah. And you hear all this. And I'm going to tell you, most of the time, those people haven't been through a third of what I've been through. And I hear that and I want to slap them. Because they're just being selfish jerks. Rose and I were in a room in Cedars when I first got there, before I was bedbound. There were five security people in the room because a woman was just going nuts, screaming and yelling really, really carrying on.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's because they're ungrateful. And I think when I talk to doctors, when you find a patient who's all woe is me, why don't you help guide them into gratitude and understand and say to them, wait, are you in a warm bed? Is there a roof on your head? Are you in a building where everybody here wants to make you better? Are you surrounded by modern medicine? Do you have any family that loves you? I mean, there is so much to be grateful for that, you know, that people just constantly overlook how much gratitude they should be giving.
That's an amazing outlook. I feel that most people wouldn't, you know, have the grace to really look at it that way.
I don't know if it's grace. It's just, I think it's reality. You know, I look at these things as reality.
It's a fantastic reality. We're going to take a brief break right now, but please don't go anywhere because we will be back with much more from author Stephen G. Taibbi.
Healthcare Confidential is brought to you by Prescriptive Communications, LLC. Analyze, strategize, connect. That's our prescription for healthcare marketing. Prescriptive Communications puts healthcare businesses in front of the audiences they need to reach. If you're ready for a diagnostic on your marketing efforts, get in touch with Prescriptive today. Call us at 631-606-0525 or visit prxcommunications.com. That's 631-606-0525 or prxcommunications.com.
Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with Stephen G. Taibbi, patient advocate and author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. And Stephen, you just shared with us your amazing philosophy, which is to really feel gratitude even in, under the worst of circumstances, which is incredible to me. But I want to shift the focus a little bit and talk about your how you're active with the organ donor community. What are some of the concerns right now and the needs of that community?
Well, I had to go to California for my second heart transplant because there were no heart there are no hearts in New York. This is really very sad, but New York is number 50 out of 50 in the states for donation. That's pretty pitiful, isn't it?
Why is that?
Nobody gives. This is the least giving state in the nation. And I think it's shameful. I think it's a real shame. And then you go to other states, you know, you go to the South, the Midwest, you go the South, the Midwest, that no problems, you know. Tennessee just broke the record for how many heart transplants they performed at Vanderbilt. They're the number one heart transplant place in the world right now. They've done more heart transplants at Vanderbilt this past year. We're going, you know, it's only a few months in this year, but the past year they had the most. I forgot what the number was. It's a huge number. I had to go to California because my doctor knew a doctor there, and they have plenty of hearts there. And when I was in California, there were five other patients from New York hospitals at Cedars waiting for hearts. And the wait time in New York at the time when I was waiting was over a year and a half. And I didn't have a year and a half. And they told me when I got to Cedars, they literally had a guy come in and 2 hours later, he got his heart, literally. The average wait time in Cedars is under 3 weeks. So yeah, it's
big difference. So what can we do about that? What are some strategies that we can employ to address that?
Well, the OPO should be doing more, that's the organ procurement organization. Every state has one, two, or three of them. And that's where when you get listed for an organ, it goes to that organ procurement organization. And they're the ones who connect with the national organization, you know, and UNOS, and which is the United Network of Sharing of Organ Sharing. And you get listed on. So, you know, you've heard that when you get listed as a transplant patient, you become a number. This way there's no buying, no selling or any of that. It becomes very, anonymous. And you just become a number. And but the OPO in LA is astounding. That's one legacy. It's probably the best OPO in the country, one of the best in the country. They just, everywhere you go, there's stuff about organ donation. And everybody in LA signed up. Everybody. It's almost like a religion there. Everybody is signed up. Here, not so much. So that's one thing that could be done. I think that that there needs to be more awareness. I mean, I'd like to see, you know, some more commercials and some more, even things on the posters on buses, for gosh sake, something. But I don't see anything about being a donor, you know, here. So,
and it's super easy right here in New York to become a donor. What's the process here?
Yes. It should be being taught in the schools too. I don't mean like a class, but maybe every year the OPO should have people come in and teach, talk to the students. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that you should try to talk somebody into it. If somebody wants to do it, they do it. If they don't, they don't do it. That's right. Fine.
But they do no need problem. The information just to make that decision.
Just the information, right.
Yeah. And what do we do here? We just sign the back of our driver's license, I think.
Yeah, you can sign the your driver's license. You can call Live On New York, which is our OPO down here. And you can fill out a form there, or you can do it on your driver's license. It's better to do it on your driver's license because that's immediate. If you do it on it goes into the system if you do it through the OPO, but best way to do it is through both. So mm-hmm. that you're in the mainframe and you're in the computer and you're on the license, you know. So
great. So I want to just finish by asking you to give us your advice. If you had kind of a soapbox and you could speak to healthcare providers, and by that I mean across the spectrum, doctors, nurses, even administrators, on how they can improve the patient experience, what would your message be to that world?
I think the biggest thing with doctors, well, it's not the biggest thing, it's the thing that first comes to mind, though, is that they have to understand that when they're in a hospital room talking to a patient, the patient is mostly naked, laying on a bed, lower than the doctors. The doctors have all the power. That patient is terrified. That patient is terrified. That a lot of the times, me not so much anymore, but I've certainly been. And let's just assume that they are. That patient needs soothing. We could use a lot less of the stuff that's going on now, like some of the stuff that got me through my first catheterization when I got sick the first time for my first heart transplant. I was so freaking scared. And this nurse, Denise, she just took my hand during that procedure and she held my hand. And I cannot tell you what that did for me. Just these little human things. Doctors need to I know they need to protect themselves. I really understand that. But I have this attitude about it because I'm like, well, you're the one who picked the idea that you wanted to be a doctor. So too bad, because this is part of being a doctor. I know it's hard for you emotionally, but that's what you picked to do. So that's what you have to do because that's part of what you're doing. And the more that they are human to their patients, the more that everybody is human. And I don't mean like, you know, hotel, like a lot of hospitals are doing now. They're bringing in hotel people to teach them how to treat guests. They're not guests. When a hospital calls me a guest, I get angry. And I go, is this a Holiday Inn or are you going to work on me? I am not your guest. I am your patient. Talk to me properly. Don't talk to me like that's condescending to me. Stop being condescending. Stop these stupid band-aids of, hi, my name is, that's what they're doing now. Hi, mm-hmm. my name is, this is what we're going to do. No, don't do that. Just have frank conversations and tell them what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, take out the BS niceness of it and just be human and connect with the patient. That's probably the biggest thing, is connect with the patients on every level. I connect with every person who comes into my room. I connect with the person who sweeps my floor because that person's important. And they are. They keep that mm-hmm. room clean. That person helps me not get infected. That's an important person. So I connect with that person. I connect with the person who brings me my food. I connect with the nurses and the doctors and the phlebotomists. I connect with every single person. And it's really great to see that when you do that, they connect back. I'd like to see doctors be the ones who do it first more. I know it's hard. They have to do it so many times, but I think that would help tremendously.
But you bring just such a unique perspective to this conversation. And I think that you have so much really wisdom to share just based on all of your experiences with the healthcare system. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Would you mind telling listeners where, first of all, where they can purchase your book? Because I think everyone should buy themselves a copy. And then where else they can go to learn more about you?
Of course, everybody buys their books on Amazon. I know Barnes & Noble carries it. But it's on all the e-sites. And I know it's on several bookstores. You know, I guess it's hit or miss with the bookstores. I don't know. But Barnes & Noble carries it. People have told me. And my website is gratefulguilt.com. Most people actually connect through me on my Facebook page, believe it or not. It's, my Facebook page is on Facebook. Stephen Taibbi Author is my Facebook page that I'm on LinkedIn too.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I also want to remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available on heliumradio.com on Mondays at 10 a.m. on the Care One Network and at 2 p.m. on the Life Improvement Radio Network. You can listen on demand wherever you access podcasts. Our show is produced by Life Improvement Media with thanks to Eric Remmel and Justin Ulrich. And our theme song is an original composition written and performed by the fabulous Patrick Bukarsik. Before we go, I want to remind listeners that the 5th annual Toolkit for Independence, a virtual conference dedicated to the success of America's independent doctors, will be held on March 25th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Secure your free guest ticket or join us as a sponsor. Learn more at toolkitforindependence.com. That's toolkitforindependence.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Helium Radio. The views expressed by show hosts or their guests are their own and should not be construed in any way as advice from Helium Radio. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our website. Personal perspectives expressed by producers, writers, and editors will always be presented as such. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without the express written consent of Helium Radio is strictly prohibited. Thanks for listening.